You're now listening to La Verdad Podcast. Bueno, mi gente, welcome back to another episode of La Verdad Podcast. This is your host, Christian.
Joined by the one and only V-Fig.
You're a little quieter today. What happened?
I'm not quiet. I'm good.
You're good?
Yeah.
It might be that the area and the noise kind of gets me. Before, it used to be like right here, right next to me, so I could hear you really nice and clear. Now it's like I have to be a little bit closer to you.
Maybe.
To kind of get the
no, I'm good.
The full range. How you been?
Man, it's been crazy. I just got promoted, but I'm still kind of doing my other job. So, like, working all these hours, and I haven't been able to relax for a little while. But, I mean, it's a good problem, right? It's a good problem to have.
You got a new phone, I see.
I did. I just still haven't. I'm so ghetto. I have not taken off the plastic yet, because I'm going to wait until I get a new case. So, until then, that plastic is staying on there. I don't care.
So, we missed you on the last episode. Two episodes ago, you weren't here. You took a little break. She was actually at a bachelorette party.
Oh, yeah. That happened, too.
And then we had Marissa. Marissa's actually in the background today taking pictures. So, big shout out to Marissa, who was able to be with us for the La Verdad podcast 2 weeks ago. So, before we begin the podcast, though, I want to ask you guys to please like, share, subscribe to our YouTube channel. If you go to any of our social media platforms, you can find us at La Verdad LTD. Facebook, Instagram. We're not on Snapchat yet, but Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So go ahead and like us there. We do have a bunch of different podcasts up lately. We've been recording left and right. We have different sessions with different people. So back in the day, we used to just have the one podcast. Now we have kind of like a merge of three in one. So we have, and I mentioned this before, we have the regular La Verdad podcast, we have group talk, and then we have El Backstage, which is the one in collaboration with the Segundo Ruiz Belvis Cultural Center. So with that being said, also follow the Segundo Ruiz Belvis Cultural Center. They're available online at srbcc.org. So for today's show, we're actually joined by a cultural worker, I want to say. Also, a very prominent figure here in the, I want to say, the Puerto Rican community and in the Chicago community. We have Evaristo Tito Rodriguez. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Yeah. I'm doing, yes.
Awesome. Would you say that that's kind of like who you are? You're well known in the Puerto Rican community or the whole Chicago community?
Well, that's what people say.
Yeah.
So, I've been around quite a few years doing community organizing and culture worker for probably about 40 years. I started very young. Mm-hmm. My age, I found my passion, which also helped me develop my self-identity and helped me while I was in college and continue my career. So I wear a lot of different hats in the Puerto Rican community, the Latino community, and, you know, pretty much the universe community, if you want to say so.
So were you born and raised here in the Chicago area?
I was born in Chicago. Mm-hmm. At the age of six, I moved with my mom to Puerto Rico.
Okay.
I was raised in Dorado, right at the exit of Rio La Plata in the Barrio Mamillal. And the exit into the ocean. So I grew up between the river and the sea, El Campo, a beautiful time of my life until I was about 14. And then my mom got sick, so I had to come back to live with my father in Chicago.
Okay.
At the age of 14, total culture shock.
It was It's very interesting you mentioned that you lived in Puerto Rico and then came back for like the high school age, because I feel like a lot of the people perhaps from your generation kind of went through that same lifestyle. I want to say my dad did the same thing. Mm-hmm. My mom kind of did the same thing, and then we've interviewed like my uncles and everybody, and they lived in Puerto Rico during like their grammar school years, came back to Chicago, or perhaps went back and then like back and forth a lot.
Yeah,
I don't think that happens as much nowadays. It's yeah, very
well,
interesting.
Well, they used to call that the yo-yo generation.
Oh, that's
the
so
back
funny.
And forth. You know, I think that happened more often during that time period of our history and the establishment of Puerto Ricans in Chicago, because it happened. I want to say it happens between the 70s and the 80s.
Okay.
As Puerto Ricans had established themselves in the 40s, 50s, and the 60s, mm-hmm. and Chicago got a little bit of money and figured, okay, we're going back home.
Yeah.
Because the idea was always to go back home,
right. yeah.
go back to Puerto Rico, right. you know, and a lot of them end up doing that and then realize, you know, Puerto Rico had changed by then and it was getting a little bit harder
yeah.
To stay. A lot of the younger generation, pretty much while their parents stay in Puerto Rico, they will come back to Chicago
yeah.
and back to high school and then to college or university.
And I felt like the whole back and forth lifestyle happened a lot during that time. So, for example, like you mentioned, the parents were there. So abuelita and abuelito were over in Puerto Rico. But, you know, my parents, for example, or something like that, will travel back and forth. Do you think it had to do with more also with the economical aspect in the island? Like things were more expensive than for our grandparents?
I think it was economical in both sense over here and over there.
Oh, okay.
And I think it was they realized soon that going back to the island, even though they had their home and built already and established, that the resources that they had over here did not exist in the island.
Right.
Yeah.
A lot of it had to do with political also,
yeah.
because being in the island and being a citizen and not being able to affect
mm-hmm.
the presidential
yeah, yeah. Yeah.
elections. Yeah. I mean, there's so many different right. situations here.
Yep.
But I think above all, I think it also has to do a lot with understanding at the end of the day, what is it that our parents, grandparents wanted, and then how that changed with the other generations that came after.
Yeah.
They said, do I want what my father and my mother wanted? Do
yeah.
I want what my grandparents wanted?
Mm-hmm.
And then they realized that even though they wanted that, it was more an ideal, you know, an illusion
yes.
or
yes.
some...
You read my mind.
Yeah,
right?
it was more like a romanticism.
Yes,
I must
yes.
say, I love Puerto Rico.
Going to the U.S.,
yeah.
this American dream, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think, and I've seen this in other podcasts and other recordings, is that a lot of people have mentioned this American dream that they had, right, back in the island, our grandparents, for example. Then they realize, like, it's not really that dream. You know, you get a house, it tiene a mortgage, and then you can't really afford it. It's 30 years that you're... Locked into one place, and
yep.
there's not a lot of them that were able to go back, because the mentality back then, I think, was I'm gonna go save up, I'm gonna work, make so much money in the U.S., perhaps buy a car, a
mm-hmm.
house, and then I'm gonna go back to Puerto Rico, and that American dream, or that it was more of a romance, you know, they romanticized it. It
mm-hmm.
wasn't necessarily what was happening.
Yeah,
so. You went, you lived in Puerto Rico for the grammar school years. When you came here and you mentioned you had a culture shock, what do you mean by that?
Well, by then, I already have forgotten all the English I had learned.
Oh, really?
Because they teach you English in Puerto Rico, right?
They do, but it's, you know what, is, I think it's already a natural reaction.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
To not necessarily assimilate completely.
Yeah.
Okay.
But ponte a pensar too, because when people learn Spanish in high school here,
yeah,
they really don't get it, right?
Yeah.
Unless you're submerged in the culture, just speaking the language 24
yeah.
hours, then
yeah,
it's a little bit
different.
Different.
I mean, but that's a whole nother episode
yeah.
of language and all that. But yeah, sorry, go ahead.
But yeah, you're supposed to learn English since first or second grade.
Okay.
But I when I got there, actually, I found myself teaching the English teacher English. at age 6 and teaching her new songs that I had already learned in the United States. One little, two little, three little Indian. It was kind of, I didn't remember all of this until later on in my life. And I said, you know what? I was teaching this teacher how to teach, you know. But by the age of 14, I had graduated from ninth grade in Puerto Rico. I was going into high school. I was in my safe haven, and all of a sudden, my life totally changed from one day to another. So my mom got sick. She called my father in Chicago, come and pick up your kids, because I'm not feeling well, and you know. So it was one of these situations where my father showed up to school a Friday afternoon, pick up my transcripts without me knowing anything. Supposedly we're going on a mini vacation to St. Thomas, and we landed in Chicago. I'm still in that mini vacation since then. So I realized where I was a couple of days later, because I kind of remember the space from coming before to Chicago. So it was like, okay, I somehow I got tricked here, you know. So I didn't know the language, English. Yeah. They go and enroll me in Roberto Clemente High School. Luckily, they had a bilingual program.
Okay.
And the fourth floor, was a world in itself within the school.
Okay.
So if you were going up the escalators and you came upon the fourth floor and you kind of just kind of blink, you say, where am I? Because everybody was talking Spanish, singing, I mean, just like in the movies. Yeah, very happy, making jokes, this and that. And it was a totally different world. I remember getting so used to the fourth floor that I would hate having any other classes in any other floor.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
I would get nervous because
that floor was for like international students.
It was pretty much the bilingual program.
Oh, okay.
It was established on the fourth floor.
Yeah.
So everybody knew your language. Everybody, even though we were Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Peruvian, all Latin Americans, we had a common language that we spoke.
Yeah.
With some difficulties, because obviously we understand Spanish and different part of Latin America is not taken the same way,
right.
You know. So sometimes, you know, we would mention a word that was probably offensive to other people.
Yeah.
But then, you know, we would squash it right there, and they pretty much, and they say, oh, no, for us, this means this. And they say, oh, that's pretty much how we learn Spanish from Latin America. It's pretty much by error and trial, you know.
Everybody did. If you don't mind me asking, around what year was that?
This was 1976.
Yeah, so I like to put myself in that, you know, that story, that year, and thinking about other people that we brought on the show that perhaps have gone to Roberto Clemente High School. And around that era, it was a little rough from what I've heard, right? So
I got stories from many.
So it's interesting that you found like a safe haven within the school,
awesome.
Right?
Because I mean, I want to say there were always the problems of gangs. There's so much that is going on at this point that I really did not know because I was not in Chicago.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So we have the post Young Lord era.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's a whole bunch of revolution going on at Tweed High School to name Roberto Clemente the new school, Roberto Clemente. The whole UIC issue with taking the land of Puerto Ricans in that area and establishing rights. The Palante, which is pretty much the lattice program to bring Latinos into the universities. Yeah. And I'm coming after all of this, not aware what's happening. I see myself all of a sudden participating of rallies, because in Puerto Rico, my mom was an activist.
Okay.
So there was a piece of land in our barrio that was pretty much owned by people who raise cattle or grow sugarcane, but for about 5 or 6 years had not done anything with that piece of land.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, sure enough, the the land was there and not being used. So what the people do in the island when there's land and not being used, we appropriate it, you know. So we,
happens a lot.
Yeah. So, you know, my mom taught me since I was a little kid, we go into El Capitolio to march for this, to march for that.
Wow.
So this is something that my mom always, you know, put in me. Education is first, you know, the rights of human beings, you know, above everything, love your neighbor.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I was the oldest in my family. So I was, you know, she always said, you're the man of the house. Mm-hmm. Even at 9 years old, you know. So she really raised me as a totally independent man.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she taught me how to wash clothes, how to clean the house, how to planchar, how to make food. Because she said, you know, if you're gonna get married, it's not by necessity. Yeah, it's by love.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and I said, okay. At that time, I didn't know what that meant.
Yeah. And that's a very revolutionary way of thinking, I want to say, during that era as well.
And I think my mom was very ahead of her time in those times. So when I come to Chicago, we have that little safe haven on the fourth floor. Before I know it, there's issues that wanting to bus, the busing issue of busing students out and busing students in. And before I knew it, I find myself in a speed up club and organizing a whole bunch of youth to rally. And later
during my high school.
And then I realized later on that there was a whole bunch of files kept by the FBI and the police of Chicago, las carpetas, you know?
Yeah.
Which is another big issue. And then later on, 10 or 15 years later, realizing, whoa, I'm in some of these photographs, you know? What is going on here? So even though they had the carpetas in Puerto Rico, you know, they were also having these kind of carpetas here in the United States. So I pretty much go through, establish myself as in the leadership of Aspira, a community organization that during that time, and still today, leadership through education, you know. Actually, I am employed by Aspira at this moment and have been for the past 22 years.
Wow.
So I'm an aspirante since 79 and still all the way today, still believe in the Aspira mission and vision. You know, the Aspira process of awareness, analysis, and action, you know, all of these things were part of my upbringing. And then to top it off, I meet a science teacher who in itself was like a genius when it came to the Puerto Rican culture and the fine arts.
Interesting. Okay.
So he was at that time organizing a whole bunch of cultural events at Roberto Clemente, his name Orlando Jimenez. And became my mentor and my spiritual father.
And would you say at that time, because for those that are viewing the podcast, you're also the director of Africa Caribe, right? And we'll talk more about that. But during your high school time, were you a musician already? Or?
So I think I was always a musician because in Puerto Rico, you know, it doesn't matter. There's always the action of music and singing and stuff like that. Yeah, because in the carnaval, even if it was with a can and a spoon, and during Christmas time, you do the aguinaldos, the parrandas and stuff like that. So music was always around us as part of that. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting, it was that while I was at Roberto Clemente, a classmate, Mexican, asked me, you know, because we were having something about Puerto Rico, and I said, so when was Puerto Rico discovered? And, you know, what is the national anthem? What does it mean? And me just coming from Puerto Rico is just like somebody hit me over the head and knocked me out. Because I went blank. And I couldn't explain, just arriving from the island, you know, which put my in question my identity as a Puerto Rican. I said, wait a minute, I should know these things. Yeah. I was there for a few years, you know, I should. And then I realized I didn't know who I was.
That's very interesting you mentioned that. And I think we brought this up in the podcast before. For you, it happened during the high school, your high school time, right? Mm-hmm. For me, I felt like that happened my freshman year in college, where I was put in a place where I was the only Puerto Rican, probably the only Latino in the room. And I had to question my identity. And I was like, damn, do I know the anthem? Do I know any history of Puerto Rico? I only knew a couple little things here and there. Mm-hmm. So then that kind of sparked this interest in me to really dive in there and pick up. I bought so many books, and I have a bunch of books about Puerto Rico and research here and there, because I needed to know who I was in order for me to know what I wanted to be later on in life. So it's very interesting. I feel like everybody kind of goes through that.
Yeah.
That little, like, enlightenment, right?
Too, yeah.
Yeah, so for you, it was in high school, me, college. I think for you, it was in college.
Yeah, for me, it was college, too. But unlike you, I wasn't the only one. Okay. There were other people
Because you were at DePaul, right?
Yeah,
so there's a lot more Latinos there. I was stuck in the boondocks in Joliet over there.
Yeah, different experiences, but same kind of, you know, goal behind it is discovering who you are.
So your mentor, Orlando, right?
Yes.
He kind of got you interested in the arts?
So he was doing all these activities after my incident with my classmate that later on becomes my roommate at college at Loyola University.
Wow.
And later on becomes my compadre.
Damn,
you know?
That's awesome.
And he is the one that first takes me to Mexico on a tour to his hometown, meet the grandmother of my future wife.
Wow.
So I was like, okay. So it's so many different things going on. Yeah, so Orlando Jimenez pretty much gave me the opportunity and to put the cultural music dance aspect to the identity historical aspect.
Okay.
And always led the door open. Mm-hmm. He never said, here, this is it. He said, no, here, there's more out there. Mm-hmm. It's up to you to look for it.
Okay.
So later on, as I become a cultural worker, this is pretty much what I tell people. I say, I'm not giving you all I have because all I have is not all what it is.
Yeah.
It is only the key to open that door. The rest is on you.
I like that. Yeah.
You know, so I go through my 3 years at Clemente, I become the president of the bilingual program, the student bilingual program committee. As part of that committee, we create a drama club, a dance club, awesome. A music club, La Tuna de la Clemente during that time, which was like Estudiantina. We did so much work. I was doing work with Aspira clubs. There was so many different things happening. I had, because of my responsibilities in the school, I had a key for the book closet.
Okay.
So there was one day I go in there and there's a treasure in there about Puerto Rican history book that we never saw.
And it was just hitting.
It was there. Yeah. So I would take every single minute going there like myself and just start reading. I mean, that's pretty much my high school years. And then I went to Loyola and another culture shock, because I was, during my years at Clemente, was in the bilingual program.
Yeah.
I really did not learn any English.
Yeah, because you're stuck within the same. Kind of happened to me, too. I wasn't bilingual until about sixth grade. And
you know, so
shot.
Now I know what I want. Yeah. By the way, by no means what my counselor wanted for me, which was to go to Truman College, so a theater presentation and stuff like that. She would never give me any applications for any other colleges that I wanted to. Thank God for my Aspira counselor that said, what school you wanted to go to? And I said, no, I want to go to UIC, Urbana-Champaign, I want to DePaul, Loyola, he says, okay. So he helped me pretty much apply to all of these schools.
And at that time, UIC, DePaul, and Loyola, I know for sure perhaps UIC was much more Puerto Rican centered, had a lot of Puerto Rican students. Northeastern, by any chance, was it during that time?
Well, Northeastern always has been kind of a linkage, yeah. Even from the early 70s. Okay. You know, so I'm like in the beginning. I graduated in 79.
Okay.
So pretty much this is the time period where, you know, I'm looking at all these schools because people are telling me these are the good schools.
Okay, that's the question.
And
yeah.
These, and so my mom says you always want to go to the best schools. Mm-hmm. You know, don't sell yourself short.
Yeah.
That's right.
So but when I get there, to my surprise, you know, it's just like, do I have the knowledge to really be in this school?
Yeah.
But going back again, my counselor, she would not give me any of the applications. I fill out all the applications, was subject to all the school that I,
wow. Yeah.
So I made copies and I took all the copies and I told my counselor and my broken English, it say, here, it is a, my diploma, your last day of work.
Damn.
Oh.
So sure enough,
damn.
six years later, after so many, because again, I'm at Loyola University, which is not an easy school to go to.
Right.
I have to be working on my papers like 6 or 7 times, review it because I have to do it in Spanish, rewrite it, then retranslate it, and then give it to somebody else, take it to the English lab, mm-hmm. make sure that everything is okay. Then, while people were doing their papers in 2 or 3 times, I had all this time. I graduated in 6 years. Later, married with 2 kids, and sure enough, make a copy of my diploma. The counselor is still there, all wrinkly, falling apart, and they said, do you remember me?
Uh-huh.
And she opened her eyes, she didn't want to say anything, and they say, remember what I told you. It's time for you to retire. And I gave her my Loyola University diploma.
Wow.
And sure enough, that was her last year there.
Wow.
She did retire. And I did it and went and complained about her and everything else. And I just can't imagine how many other people
kids,
she did
that,
you know, that she discouraged.
Yeah, discouraged.
You know, and I'm saying, and now I do realize sometimes we don't have the means or we don't have the skills, okay, that merits to go to that school.
Right.
What saved me was my strong sense of identity, my willingness to follow my mom's direction.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and at the end of the day, it was understanding how I utilize culture, because once I went to Loyola, I also established, I was part of LASO, and I was the president.
Wow.
I was the chairperson of the social culture committee. So I used that.
And you had it as your support system too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I had that as a way to be around people who thought like me, who loved these things, and that might have been a little bit off in their identity, but were pursuing who they were while they were in college or
and
university.
I think that's so important, because I think just in the Latino community that they, you know, like you said, maybe don't have all the skills to get, you know, to be successful in these schools, but what, you know, you had your sense of identity already established, and some of them don't, but I think what saves them is that support system. You know, at DePaul, they have so many different organizations and clubs that are there to support the Latino community, because they know that, okay, you got accepted, you made it in, but so many of them like fail out, you know?
Because you don't have the support.
No, anyone supporting them. And so I think that's so great, and I wish more people would take advantage of
and
that.
And it's awesome, too. I'm a product of LASO as well, from Lewis University, which was another branch of the Latin American Student Organization. And if it wasn't for LASO, you know, within LASO, that kind of motivated me to start a Latino fraternity. And because of that, you know, it kept me going. And that's why we have a podcast, a Latino-centered podcast.
You have that
today. Yeah, so I'm a big advocate of that, of getting yourself involved in the especially in college, because it's so hard and you get discouraged by money, right?
Oh, yeah.
A lot of times, and there might be certain people there that might hook you up and help you out. So you were involved with LASO. What other organization you mentioned?
I was at Loyola. I was part of the Spanish club. This is the time where El Salvador is going through some turmoil. I came 10 years later after some other Puerto Ricans have been there already kind of stirring around the Loyola campus, which I realized later on why they were looking at me kind of weird, because they were saying, oh, that's the radical Puerto Rican, you know. They actually try to isolate me from my friends and stuff like that, saying you're going to get in trouble if you hang around with him and stuff like that.
By they, who do you mean?
Administration.
Okay.
Yeah. And
wow.
So I put together a committee with the different Latino organizations in LASO to request for a Latin American Studies minor.
Wow.
Because we didn't have one.
Yeah. And so was that a big thing back then?
Well, we...
Like other schools had it?
Yes. Yeah, yes. Okay. So, you know, I wanted to make sure that at least I had a minor before I graduated. And it took about 2 years. But I remember sitting down at the table and people, you know, mind you, I started college when I was 17 years old. So this is 19 years old, you know, people thinking like, you know, this kid don't know what he wants.
Yeah.
So he say, well, you know, Latin American studies programs is too much. We're not offering enough classes to it. I said, so I let them talk. Well, I said, you know what? Ever since I sit here, all I have heard is excuses not to have it. And I totally understand from your point of view. You don't want to get uncomfortable. The problem is that I'm paying my money here in this institution.
Yep. I have a right.
You know, and I have a right to make you uncomfortable.
Yes.
And they say, I'm not requesting anything out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
So I pull out a sheet of paper with all the classes, and I think, because I'm not the educator here, I'm not you, and all the chairpersons are right here of the different, that these classes can provide and be linkaged to this. Mm-hmm. And when they started looking at them, they say, and they say, I know you have enough for a major, not for a minor. All I'm asking is a minor. Well, we'll get back to you. And they say, well, that's not good enough. So I got a little bit loud. And they threatened with kicking me out of the school, and I said, that's fine if that's what you want to do, but you're going to miss out a lot. Yeah. And pretty much they got me in a committee to work with the chairpersons of the different departments to make sure that we finish that. But my last semester that I finished my degree there, I was able to get all my classes and asked for the minor in Latin American Studies program. So I was very happy at that time.
And what was your major?
Spanish and political science.
Wow. You double majored.
Yeah.
And you had the minor.
The minor.
Yeah. And that's I had three minors.
Oh. Wow. Hold on. Yeah.
Latin American Studies, philosophy, and religion.
And during that time as well, were you also doing all of the other, like, music and...
So, during that time, I'm going to Loyola University. I'm together with my wife.
Wow.
And So, I started in 79 at Loyola. In 82, I was part of the foundation of El Ballet Folclórico Puertorriqueño Yucayeque, which was here in Chicago, which was the first professional folkloric dance group of Chicago. So it took us from 81. So all of this, you know, again, did it with Orlando Jimenez, working with him. that was established on February 14, 82, and November 12, 83, we do our grand gala at the Congress Hotel in downtown with 16 couples. And we did all the different style of dancing from Puerto Rico.
Wow.
Ballroom, jíbaro, bomba, plena, even theater presentation. It was a 3-hour show. I mean, it was.
During that time, if you could take me there, and how was the Puerto Rican community here in Chicago? Was it tight? Was it kind of like people everywhere? Was there a big community or small community?
This is the time where most of the Puerto Rican community is in the Humboldt Park. This is when
really family oriented, really.
Yeah, this is pretty much after Lincoln Park. This is pretty much the enclave of the Puerto Rican community is in the Humboldt Park. So we have the Puerto Rican parade.
So that was already started.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And also it was the time of a lot of FBI activity in the Puerto Rican community.
COINTELPRO and all that.
Because, yes. Yeah. Because this is the time where La FAL, Fuerzas Armadas de Liberación Nacional, did a few bombings in Chicago, then New York. You know, 1980, April 4th is when they detained the Puerto Ricans, you know, in Evanston or something like that. I'm in Loyola at that moment. You know, we have an event, all of a sudden everybody stops and there's an announcement about that. This the FBI is all, I'm part of a church also that is linkage to some of the members that were taken because I was doing also my activism work through the church.
Are you able to mention the name of the church or not?
Yes. Yeah. First Congregational Church of Chicago.
That's the one that doesn't exist anymore?
No, they're right now. It still exists. It was run by Reverendo Jose Alberto Torres. And it is right now, originally that church was on Ashland near Madison.
Okay, yeah.
Right in front of the, is that the Union Park that is right there? There's a park right in front of it.
I can't remember. I think so.
So then they have, their church right now is on Grand Avenue, Potomac, and Hamlin.
Okay.
Yeah. So From that church, I became also the youth leader of the youth group at the. I also became a tutor. Yeah. I will be there.
You weren't lying about those many hats.
A director of the summer programs there, and then because Cameron School was next door, we were seeing a lot of their students trying to get into our facilities at the church, because they didn't have anything to do. So we created an after-school program for them, a tutoring section. And then I went back to school to see what's going on. There was no programs going on at the school. So I ran for PTA president at 19. Wow. And the principal thought that he had me in his pocket. To his surprise, he wanted to cut the boundaries to not allow any of the kids from south of Division because they were African Americans into the school. And I said, no, that's not happening. And we had a big war, but I had the PTA by then.
Yeah.
Well, it became crazy. So we so 1980s in Chicago is
was a
not
lot going on.
Yeah.
Especially within the Puerto Rican community. Yeah. So you were at Loyola, you mentioned, right? This happened where they were, you know, investigating. So I'm assuming they were probably investigating you as well for many years.
Yes.
We're looking into
there was.
I know when we had the conversation with Cha-Cha, this is around almost the same time. And he was mentioning some of those, and I was trying to put myself in that situation. Like, what would I do, right? Because nowadays, it's like you guys went through that. You know, you know what it is. But if I'm 19 and I'm in, or 19, 20 in a meeting, and the FBI walks in, what the hell would I say? You know, how did you feel at that moment?
Well, I think what because I already knew how to proceed from also studying some criminal justice at the school, because I intentionally, my first major was going to be pre-med, and then I went to criminal law, and then I said, no, politics. And then I was about to do an internship in the Puerto Rican community with a politician, and I saw it was so dirty that I said, forget it. I still hang with the political science. But it was very interesting because I knew my rights. So what they did is actually they came to the house asking some questions and said, I can't answer those questions.
Yeah.
And I said, well, why will you not answer the question? This is because, I, you know, this two of you, and, you know, the reason why they walk around in pairs is that they, one can say something and the other one can say, yeah, he said that. So as they back each other up when this is just a one-to-one conversation.
Yeah.
So they left and then came back when I wasn't there and harassed my wife.
Wow.
My kid was 5 months old at that time, and they talk about, you know, little kids disappearing all the time and stuff like that.
God.
And my wife, you know, she didn't know much about what was going on, and they told her that I was subversive, that I was radical, that I was throwing bombs around and stuff like that. Really scare her off. And at that time, I, you know, it was like when I got back home, and then later on, a few days later, we came to the house. We didn't have anything. We were living in a basement, and they broke into the house.
Wow.
And goodness. And they didn't take anything except for that I can remember a little recorder that I used at the school to tape some of the lectures, because sometimes I'm in the classroom but I'm not there, you know, I'm somewhere else in my head, you know. So they, you know, if they took that, they took a few of,
they got a couple lectures.
Lectures, there you go. but it still affects my wife even today. She, when she remembers, she gets really nervous around authority and figures and stuff.
That's
like that.
That's very interesting. It's very similar story that a lot of Puerto Rican leaders went through during that time period. And that's why I asked you, like, what year was it? Because it makes sense, right? When you're talking about the story, it makes sense of what was happening in the area. And I feel, and I don't know, maybe you disagree or agree, that it kind of broke a little bit the spirit, but also built it to be even stronger later on in the years. I want to say people probably got discouraged during that time, scared, and there was probably things that were happening that could have made us greater nowadays that stopped because of that.
Yeah. I think it was a time in the history of the Puerto Rican development as a community, as a political force, that fragmented our community. To really make think Puerto Ricans and the political status of the island, and sticking to, you know, statehood or independence or the status quo, Estado Libre Asociado, and dividing the community and those efforts. So if you see the Puerto Rican community during the 80s, beginning to the end, this very little effort, or this little known of people coming together as one Puerto Rican force for one Puerto Rican issue.
Yes, yes.
You know, so it did, because then they said, oh, you're going to march with the independentistas? Oh, you're going to march with los estadistas? So it was a way to really separate us.
Yes.
And we lost a lot of power in that process.
And to this day, it's been one of the things that has broken us, I think.
Yes, you know,
there's a lot of separation because of who you hang out with. Mm-hmm. And I think right now that there's a big issue going on with like the Casa Puerto Riqueña, which I'm not going to get into, but it has brought that back up where it's like, it's about Puerto Rico. Forget it, put the politics aside and focus on the culture that could be lost if this is sold, you know, et cetera.
And, you know, so I'm this is 80s. Ballet Folklorico Puerto Rico en Yucayeque. I'm a student at Loyola University. I'm working a full-time job towards my last years of Loyola because I need to support my family, you know. I'm still strong in the Puerto Rican community. I'm working in different aspects. I'm working at the church, you know. So what's Ballet Folklorico is at its glory, and you know now is the ending of the 80s, and I get a proposal from Segundo Ruiz Belvis Cultural Center to become the program coordinator for cultural arts programs.
Okay.
Because of my knowledge and the culture and things like that, they want to establish some bomba and some plena workshops. And in November of 1989, I accept the position. So now I have a full-time job. I have a night job, which is also a full-time job. By then, I already have finished my school. And I started doing these workshops at Ruiz Belvis Cultural Center through the programs of the center. And then after 2 years, we established one of the groups, Grupo Yuba.
Okay. And at that time, was there other bomba instructors in the city of Chicago, or was it not really touched upon that much?
Bomba pretty much at that time, other than what was being done with Ballet Folklorico Puerto Riqueño Yucayeque, it was non-existent. I mean, the Puerto Rican population of Chicago is primarily from the center of the island.
Yeah.
So if you say bomba, they relate bomba more to the four-line verse of during the Christmas time.
Song, yeah,
bomba, you know.
That's very interesting,
Ayer pasé por tu casa y me tiraste una chancleta y yo me la comí creyendo que era una chuleta, you know, bomba, you know, stuff like that. These kind of things like that.
Not the actual musical form,
The actual Afro musical form, you know. So it was very hard to, and mind you, during this time, jíbaro music in Chicago is like, it's great. You know, 70s and the 80s, man, it was like, there must have been like four or five different places in Chicago where you can go and hear trovadores and cuatro music and stuff like that.
I hear that all the time. I mean, and salsa was really heavy during that time too. They had some of the best bands. And if you really, I always like to relate old podcasts. If you listen to one of the first podcasts that we had, we talk about the late 70s, 80s salsa bands here in Chicago that were like at its prime, the best salsa musicians here.
Yeah, and many of the musicians came from Roberto Clemente.
Yeah.
and you know, through Caribe Ruiz, there was a lot of La Justicia, you know, there was a whole bunch of different, La Unión, bunch of kids, actually, kids. These
were
kids.
Playing really good.
Playing salsa, yeah, really good. Anyways.
There's a great article called The Hidden History of Chicago Salsa, written by NPR, that talks about Caribe and all of his... that union that he started with some of the best musicians to this day.
Yeah.
But it's funny that you mentioned that, right? So you have the salsa musicians that are heavy. You have the trovadores. You know, I think Las Vegas nightclub was probably around during that time. All these little clubs started, but nothing with the Afro-Caribbean influence. Huh?
Yeah. The African influence was pretty much none. Yeah. Different from New York, that they already had, you know, and in Puerto Rico, which was the whole revolution going on. So, you know, it took us quite a few years before we started teaching the classes and doing the presentations and people really understanding, okay, this is a different kind of bomba than what we know.
Yeah. So do you think that most it was mostly based upon because the people here in Chicago were mostly from the middle of the island, as opposed to New York, they probably had more from like
Ponce, the coast, yeah, like more southern. And that's exactly what it is.
Okay.
It's the structure of the Puerto Rican community where they're coming from the island.
Such a small island, but right, it's so yeah. different, right?
The middle. Because remember that so New York has the first wave of Puerto Ricans, yeah. So the concept was you move from the center of the island to the coastal region, you establish yourself, you get enough money, and then you move on into New York.
Yeah.
When by the time it came to our time, the Puerto Ricans to come to Chicago, this was linkage also to the agricultural work, the Puerto Rican braceros.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, who were primarily brought to Lorraine, yeah. To Cleveland, Ohio, yeah. to all these things to grow potatoes and stuff like that, yeah. tomatoes. And then there were some in Chicago too. And then they saw that there was a heavy industry of iron that and steel that they would work on, and this is how the Puerto Rican actually started. That's why we have the Puerto Rican flags
yeah.
made out of steel. To remember, you know, who really, yeah, how the Puerto Rican community enclaved themselves and what kind of work they did while they were in Chicago and Indiana.
Yeah. And it's very interesting to see that, right, where Puerto Ricans are at, because even if you look at history itself, like the Puerto Ricans that are in Hawaii have like a different, you know, cultural perspective. The Puerto Ricans in New York have a different one and Puerto Ricans in Chicago. Now, you're teaching the bomba classes. You're trying to get the community to understand what bomba music is. How was the first reception? How did people react to it at first?
I think when they saw us, they thought that we were Cuban.
Por la vestimenta.
Yeah. They thought, a lot of them, that they would say, no, that's not Puerto Rican.
Yeah.
Because they had not seen anything like
Most
that
Most of
before.
The time, they probably see like the jibaro aspect, right?
Yeah.
And they don't see the different attire that you wear for bomba, right? And how did you know about that? Was it because of Orlando that you started understanding how the vestimentas and all
Yes.
That?
So part of the research of the ballet folklorico Yucayeque was pretty much going to Puerto Rico, looking for books, articles, and stuff like that, looking at photographs from the era, and looking at other folkloric groups that were in Puerto Rico also that were doing different things around the coast of Puerto Rico.
And at that time, were you studying also, I think it's called the Mason recordings of bomba music, or was that later on?
This happens later on. Okay. Even though they existed by then, it's not, I want to say, it's not into the early 90s, and you know, that a series of people started looking into these recordings and found a treasure in it, you know. But pretty much, you know, at this time, we just relying on other cultural workers, bomberos from Puerto Rico, you know. So I had connections and met many great people that are not living today. One of them, Don Rafael Cepeda, you know. I mean, literally going to his house, sitting down, and being offered coffee, like if I was another member of the house.
That's a historical figure,
going to a bobombazo, you know, and just being there and playing the choir, and my daughter, who is 5-6 years old, comes out and dance, and everybody is like, wow, you know, what's going on? So, you know, there's a lot of stuff happening, but the connections is always back to the island.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have the resources and the books that we have now today. And a lot of the things that was mentioned in the past was promoted. It's not anymore because we have found that, you know, some of the information either was distorted or was changed.
Can you give me an example of like something?
Well, it's like the different, for example, you know, the different style of bomba dancing and playing the drums and stuff like that, you know. They're always worth either families or a group of individuals that appropriated it and they say, no, this is bomba and this is the real bomba and this is how you play bomba and is, you know.
Do you sit on the drum? Do you sit on a chair?
Yeah.
Kind of thing? Yeah.
So eventually, you know, as I'm going to Puerto Rico and doing my research and talking to all these different people, I realized, well, wait a minute, there's just not one way of playing this rhythm. Mm-hmm. And it changes name when you go to a different part of the island and how they dance it and the historical view of it in different areas. Obviously, I'm learning this from a point of view of individuals that are teaching, are showing this as a form of performance or a show.
Oh, okay.
And they're also educating the people in the process.
Yeah.
So they're just picking and choosing what they want to promote and what they want to show.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, you know, it's true, you know, or at least in their mind, you know, this is the true bomba, you know. Then I realized, you know, that I couldn't get stuck in the middle of just doing a representation of just bomba from Santurce or Cangrejo or Loíza and, you know, in the southern part of Puerto Rico, that I needed to teach as many people as I could here in Chicago about the different rhythms throughout the island.
Wow. So that kind of created this per se curriculum of what you needed to teach in the bomba, for bomba classes perhaps. And this is like in the 90s.
So we're talking about now Afri-Caribe 1980, Ballet Folclórico Puertorriqueño 82 to about 95. Mm-hmm. Rhys Belvis, the classes from 89 to 91, and then Grupo Yuba being established at Rhys Belvis Cultural Center in 91 to 98, which is the year that I leave. And during that time period, I also started working as a teacher of Puerto Rican history and Spanish at the Alternative High School of Aspira.
Okay.
And that was in 94, 95. And now I, with the principal Ramon Lopez, I create a project of performing arts that is called Taller Coco Ballet, where we combine bomba, plena, hip-hop, spoken word, performance, and we created a group of youth that we pretty much travel pretty much the whole nation. And many of the universities, I mean, we opened up for Petey Thomas, for so many political figures, Lolita Lebron, you know, with these kids still today, you know, this is what they have in their heads. You know, it's just like, you know, do you remember this time? Do you remember this?
Yeah. Are they still very much active? A lot of them active?
Yes,
doing other things in the community?
Yes, yes. Many of them had, began because then 2 years, 98, Ramon Lopez established another group that is called Bombache or Bembeteo. And, you know, I become the musical director of the group. And start helping him developing some of the concept or, you know, putting music or arrangements to his work. And then in the year 2000, I said, okay, it's time for me to do my own thing. Mm-hmm. And that's when I started Afri-Caribe.
Yeah. So in 2000, you started Afri-Caribe, which we mentioned you're currently the director. Is that the right
term?
I'm
still the director, yes.
Of Afri-Caribe. And what was your... like, what was your vision of starting Afri-Caribe?
Yeah. So, I knowing already what was in the community, I did not want it to replica what was going on. I wanted to extend it. Mm-hmm. So, from the Afro perspective of Puerto Ricans, what other elements in the Caribbean unify us in the musical, spiritual, and the historical perspective of who we are as mm-hmm. Caribeños. So that's what Afri-Caribe is.
Very interesting.
It's just finding the connections from the Caribe and how different we are, but how unique we are and how similar we are. Mm-hmm. and all this different. And just finding those connections historically and the music and the dances and the songs, you know.
Yeah.
And that's pretty much what Africa Caribe has been doing. Even though our focus has been bomba, because it's pretty much what we do a lot. We done Afro-Colombian, mm-hmm. Afro-Cuban, Dominican, you know, different other rhythms from the Caribbean when it comes to the music.
So we definitely, if people want to find out more information about Africa Caribe, which is your current project, I will say,
right? Yes.
Aside from other things that you do, and man,
those
we've had,
hats,
we could, yeah, I want to bring you back on the show because we have so many other things that I want to pick your brain about. And I love history. I love Chicago history and the Puerto Rican community. So there's a lot of other questions that I had in mind, but we only have a little bit of time. So if people want to find out more about Africa Caribe, where should they go?
So we do have a musician page and Facebook, mm-hmm. You know, Africa Caribe, and we also have another one for the Africa Caribe Cultural Center. We do have a location right in the heart of the Puerto Rican community on Division and Rockwell.
Okay.
It's 2547 West Division, right next door to La Municipal Grocery Store.
Yeah.
So if you happen to be around buying your coffee and stuff like that, just go around and give us a visit. We also have the last Saturday of the month. We have since March of the year 2002, we have been continuously every single month, at least once a month, have a bombazo, nice. Which is a gathering of the people through bomba music. Freestyle, so it's not a performance. If people come and enjoy it, and this is where they get what we call the bomba bug, and they get infected, and then they can't let it go. And we've been doing that for the past 16 years.
Wow.
Nonstop.
Once a month.
I don't know of any other group who has been able to do that on an ongoing basis, mm-hmm. at least every month. So this Saturday happens to be coming up, the 28th, July 28th, is our next bombazo. It's all white bombazo.
Okay.
And we started doing this about 2 years ago when the hype on the violence in the streets started.
Okay.
As that was our way of bringing, you know, the flag of peace,
yeah.
in our community and bringing awareness about, you know, it's not only sometimes... It's good to talk about it and do something about it in March, but sometimes we can also organize events and activities that would create a space for us to know each other,
yeah.
to better understand who we are inside and then to the community that we are trying to build.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, and then it also coincides with the screening of Albo de Sombra, which is a movie by Jamie Topper about bomba in Chicago.
Yeah.
So we're going to have a great time. We're starting at 7 o'clock p.m. and all the way to 10 o'clock. And that's happening in La Casita de Don Pedro,
yep.
2625 West Division. So we always do our bombazos outdoors in La Casita during the summer. Until it's warm enough. And then La Casita is a project of the Puerto Rican Cultural yeah. Center, which is another linkage to the community, and yeah. that has to be another story. But La Casita has had bomba since its beginning.
Wow.
Because pretty much bomberos, me included, has utilized La Casita as a focus point to bring culture also
to the city.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you for coming onto the show. I definitely gonna have to book you for another one. We need to talk a lot more. Before we end the podcast though, I want to ask you if you could give us some word of advice as far as how do you keep going, right? You're so heavily involved
yeah.
with so many different organizations. I know our soul and our body just gets tired. What sparks the fire back up?
I always had an understanding that I don't have enough time on this earth to do everything that I wanted to do. So every single little second that I have needs to be utilized yeah. somehow. I didn't think I working, and after my age, I didn't think I was going to be able to do my master's. But that was in my head. Yeah. And say, there's always time for everything that you want to do.
Yeah.
You just need to organize yourself a little bit. And sometimes we create these kind of excuses for to ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, I don't have the time. Well, I don't have the time. No, we have the time.
Mm-hmm.
We have to make the time last.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think, you know, I think that's the energy comes from understanding that one element that you're doing energize the other element, mm-hmm. and energize the other project, and the other project energize the other one, and it's a circle of energy that continues. Plus, I'm always surrounded by young people.
Yeah.
So I'm always taking the youth.
Yeah,
you know,
great.
I'm sucking the energies and youth out of them to the point that I think sometimes I'm still 17 and 18. And then my
That's
body
awesome.
Let me know the day after. They say, you're not that young anymore.
That's awesome. Well, thank you for coming by.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure.
It's
thank
been awesome. Awesome stories. And like I said, we're going to have you again here on the show. V-Fig, thank you again.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone for listening, please share, subscribe, like our page. Peace and God bless.